just finished at Oxford. I'm now at the Max Planck Institute for Math in Bonn. Yeah, that's okay. This is the second talk I've given in 2 weeks, and I also made the same mistake the last one, so it's okay. as Ravi said, I'll be talking about how to do a sum over paths or a path integral approach to Clifford circuits. I've already sort of written a little outline here. The first thing, it's not at all, certainly not typical to see path integral formulations of anything in sort of finite dimensional quantum mechanics, certainly not circuits. So first off, I'm just going to tell you how you can formulate like a sum over paths approach to computing transition amplitudes for classes of circuits that are called balanced, and I'll tell you what that is. Then I'll tell you a little bit about, in particular cases, what are known as Clifford circuits are balanced. And I'll show you how this sort of path integral perspective gives a very different type of proof of a slightly weaker form of the Gottesman-Knill theorem about the efficient simulatability of such circuits. And finally, I'll tell you how you can sort of interpret the phases that will appear here in terms of an action functional for a discrete dynamics. All right, I'll leave this up here so you can keep track of where I am. But let's start. So the first thing is, what do I mean by a circuit? I'll just sort of fix that terminology from the beginning. So what I mean by an n-qubit quantum circuit, I'll ditch the quantum because I'll never use anything else. It's going to be a sequence of unitaries. I'll always denote these by C's. It's going to be some sequence of unitary operators, say n of them, where each unitary acts on n copies of d-dimensional Hilbert space. So it should be pretty self-explanatory. And associated to such a collection of unitaries, there's obviously the sort of overall unitary that's implemented by this, which is simply the product. So there's the unitary associated to the circuit C, which is the overall operation. Pretty straightforward. Also, all preparations and measurements will be in the computational basis. I'm mostly doing this just to fix notation. So preparations and measurements in the computational basis. This, which is indexed by elements A, where A is an element in the n-dimensional affine space over ZD. So it's a vector with n components, where each component comes from the integers mod D. So explicitly, it's 0 to D minus 1. But I'll often use arithmetic in Z mod D. So, and because this is going to come up a bunch, I'm going to call this space M. Right, this affine space. So what do I mean by a balanced circuit? Well, the first thing I'll tell you what a balanced unitary is. So in words, a balanced unitary is one whose non-zero elements all have the same modulus. So the first thing, a unitary U is balanced if you can write it in the following form. So if I want to compute the matrix elements in the computational basis, this notion of balance is basis dependent. Should be clear, but that's why I was specific about fixing the computational basis. Then matrix elements come in two forms. One is they're either 0, which is possible, or they're of the form n times e to the I s q q. And I'll tell you what these things are. N is a fixed positive real number. That's the same for every pair Q and Q. It's constant. And S is a function from two copies of my computational basis to the real numbers. Is everyone able to read this? Just to make sure, yeah. So what it says is that all the non-zero matrix elements of my unitary have the same modulus. And this S function is just encoding what the different phases are.
But they are arbitrary.
They're arbitrary, yeah. There's no restrictions. I mean, there are restrictions because the specification has to be unitary.
Of course.
Yeah, but it's one of this form.
And the unitaries act on the entire width of the circuit?
They don't have to, no. They could only be supported on so many of the registers or something. But that's also the case, because then any of the registers... Yeah, it'll be the identity, which is a balanced operation. Yeah. So for example, I'll give you a few qubit examples. All of the poly operations are balanced, right? The qubit poly things, the identity, the easiest one, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, it's balanced. Let me see if I get this right. The diagonal one, there's probably one more. Yeah, sorry. Well, I mean, these are all balanced matrices, whether they're the ones you want or not, who knows. Simple examples of all balanced matrices. And no.
Products of balance are also balanced.
No, it's not true. Yeah. It is true that products of these are all balanced, but it's not generally true. The product of a balanced gate isn't balanced.
Okay. So you only require that the full circuit is balanced?
Or no.
Each
individual component is balanced. That's the next step. So a circuit U is balanced if each UI is balanced. So the overall unitary implemented by it may not be balanced, but each of the unitaries in the that sort of build the circuit are balanced. So these are the types of circuits that we'll be able to write sort of paths, sum over paths formulas, which at least look much closer to what you're used to from the Feynman path integral.
The tensor product of balanced unitaries balanced?
Yes, it should be, yeah. Because that looks sort of like a block of, you know, if you think in sort of the Kronecker product, it should be balanced, yeah. Yeah, so for example, usually, and we'll see this in a second, the types of unitaries you have to consider are drawn from like an elementary gate set, and you'll build other unitaries by tensoring with the identity. They're either, you know, they act on some subset of the registers and you build the rest from tensor product. So as long as the sort of elementary ones that act on a subset are balanced, then the full ones you build will be too. Are there any other questions? So we'll be working with such things sort of throughout the talk. So, oh yes, sir.
So I'm a bit late, but is there any connection between balance and unitary key design?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what this thing is, but. If you want to talk after, I'd be happy to, or if someone else knows, yeah. All right, let's see how we can write a sum over paths type expression for this. So, so the type of thing you'd want to compute is what are the transition, you know, if you're given such a given any circuit. One thing you'd want to know is what are the transition amplitudes? What are the, you know, transition amplitudes from going from some initial computational basis element to some final one through my circuit? So this is a completely trivial step, but if you start inserting resolutions of the identity, which is what you sort of standardly do when you're defining the path integral, you can get an expression like this, where you sum over n minus 1, capital N, elements in my configuration space that I introduced. So I introduce between each, of course I can write UC as a product here, between each unitary in this sequence, I introduce a resolution of the identity. And it allows me to rewrite this in the form of so on. That's just sort of a trivial statement. I've stuck in a bunch of copies of the identity operator. And if we were doing, you know, the Feynman path integral thing, what Feynman did was you would sort of approximate what each of these expressions are, and then sort of take n capital N to infinity. You'd add more and more, like a finer and finer resolution of your time step. And that's how he gets the path integral. But here we don't have, I mean, there's no sense in sort of refining my circuit further, right? These are sort of elementary units in my circuit. So this is sort of the most refined time scale you have access to. So I can rewrite this. This is just notationally rewritten in the following form. So I can think of this sequence as a path through my configuration space. If I think of the sort of states that label my computational basis as a discrete configuration space of my system, then a sequence of points here, like this, is a path through this, where my notion of time is now just a discrete sequence that's sort of defined by the circuit. So I can think of each one of these things that I'm summing over as a path that takes n time steps to go from q0 to qn. And I'll just denote paths by gamma. And each such path is getting some amplitude, which is this expression. So maybe I may or may not need to rewrite this, but pn from q0 to qn is just this set, which is my element q, n minus 1 copies of my configuration space, which are the intermediate time steps, and my final configuration. So a path is just maybe a sequence of n plus 1 points in my configuration space, where the first one is my fixed q0 that I was concerned with, and my final is my fixed qn that I was concerned with. And this amplitude operation defines a functional on this space. Right. Fine. However, this amplitude looks almost nothing like what you might expect from the Feynman thing, right? The Feynman path integral says this is actually some fixed modulus with a phase that's given by the action or something of this path. But for balanced circuits, this functional A has a particular form. So if C is balanced, then I can write A of gamma in the following way. I'm going to go back to calling it Q0, Qn, because it's useful for me. So if I have a particular path, Q0 through my, or you know, Q0, Q1 through my configuration space, then the value when C is balanced is of the following form. It is either, and I'll stick some notation here, some number n sub c times a phase factor, which depends on all the n time steps, if it's non-zero or it's zero. And what are these values? Well, n of c is the product of the n i's, where n is the sort of the modulus of the matrix elements of the ith thing in my circuit. It's this, but for the ith term, where this function s, sorry, is of the form, well, I sum over all my elements in my circuit. And for each one of those, I have one of these phase factors. So it's the one associated to the ith, and it only depends on the I minus 1th and ith time step in my circuit. Essentially, what happens if you multiply a bunch of these together? The modulus is product together, and these phase factors will sum. So this is now much closer to the type of expression you see in a path integral, right? There's some normalizing factor at the front. And then you have now this S itself is a functional on our path space to the real numbers. So if we can now rewrite the matrix elements for a balanced circuit in the following way. So again, same sort of thing. And we'll write it in the following form. We can obviously pull our factor out front. It's no big deal. And now we can restrict to only summing over the non-zero, the paths with non-zero amplitude. I mean, there's no reason to include them in the sum. And I'll call this space, what's my notation so I can come back to it? PC. Q0, Qn, where this space consists of all of those paths in the full path space for which the amplitude is non-zero. If you do this, you can write it in this form. Is that legible? I hope so. So essentially, the reason why I would want to restrict to the non-zero paths is so I can write it this way, as opposed to having some piecewise defined function here, which is zero sometimes or a unit length complex number other times. So essentially, for balanced circuits, I have an expression which looks very much like a path integral, at least schematically, where these phase functions, which were originally just the modulus of the matrix elements in my balanced gates, sort of assemble it together into something which at least structurally plays the same role as an action. Any questions?
What is the subscript on you? It says balanced and then A, the subscript, what is that?
Oh, A sub C. So it's the amplitude associated to a given circuit. Yeah. Yeah, my C's might sometimes look like E's, but yeah, it's a C. Yep. You may as well look at an example, and by an example, I mean the thing that's the subject of the talk, Clifford circuits. What is a Clifford circuit? These might also be called generalized stabilizers. Well, in this case, it's essentially a class of circuits where the type of unitaries you consider are restricted to be drawn or built from an elementary gate set. So the first thing is my dimension D is always going to be bigger than or equal to 3 into prime. So some people like to call these quappets or something, qudits for odd prime. I'm not a fan, but it does seem to be used. It's at least less clunky than saying qudit, where D is not prime. But yeah. So the types of unitaries that I consider will be built from the following sort of elementary gates. Let's see if I can spell. There we go. There are 3 of them. One is the Fourier gate. And in the computational basis, the formula has some normalizing factor of 1 over the square root of d. Then you sum over following pairs of w, q, q, big Q, little q, where w here is going to show up a bunch. It's your favorite primitive d root of unity. The second gate is a sort of generalized phase gate. I mean, this is the generalization of the Hadamard gates to higher dimensions. Then you have a generalized phase gate, which does not look nearly like what the qubit phase gate does, but it is the appropriate generalization. So it's diagonal and just has a phase factor of, this is 2 inverse, where here the inverse is computed in Z mod D. So it's, and finally, you have a sum gate, which is a 2-qubit operation, which sums over elements q1 and q2 and sends, that's right, it basically does them a controlled sum or a sum operation, where on the first register it does nothing, and on the second register it adds the 2. So it's a sort of purely deterministic or permutation gate. And on the first register 1, it does nothing, and the second, it adds the 2 values together. So it's called a sum gate. Yeah?
And why do you restrict yourself to go beyond qubits?
To not working on qubits, or? So there's a surprisingly annoying reason about this. It has to do with what the phase gate is on qubits. So the qubit phase gate is, I think I already drew it. It's this one, right? And it'll be relevant in a second, the fact that all of the phases are dth roots of unity, whereas here, these are fourth roots of unity, not second roots of unity. So it actually makes a fairly significant difference. But we'll see in a moment why. Maybe a less mathematical reason is that at least for this last section on the action functional, we're going to make use of the Wigner representation and the fact that it gives a positive representation, and that doesn't happen for qubits. So there are two related but not identical reasons for why. And the reason we restrict to odd primes, you'd probably just get away with odd, but there's a statement about what subgroup of the unitaries do these gates generate. It's not known for odd prime. Well, maybe it's not known. It's the group we want it to generate is the normalizer of the polygroup, and it's not known whether this is a generating set for the normalizer of the polygroup. So from inspection, these are all balanced gates, right? For each of them, in this case, our modulus is 1 over root d, 1 and 1. And they always have a given function s, which in this case is q times q, in this case is this thing, which control the phases. So what does, what sort of things, how would we write down the expression for the matrix elements here? So basically, there's three pieces of information I need to give you from this expression, right? Given a circuit, what is the modulus, right? What is the function which appears in the phase? And what is my space of paths which have non-zero amplitude, right? So I can just tell you what those are. The first thing is, what is our amplitude? Well, you give me a given circuit C, whose elementary gates are built from these ones, or whose unitaries are built from these. What is the amplitude? Well, it's pretty simple. It's 1 over d times the number of Fourier gates that appear in my circuit over 2, right? Because I get a square root of 1 over square root of d for every Fourier gate. That's pretty straightforward.
So you're saying any product of those will be balanced?
Product in which sense?
Or collection, like how do you build them together to get the unitary?
Sure. So the types of unitaries that can appear in a Clifford circuit are ones which are the identity on most qubits, but are either act by F on one qubit, act on R by one of the qubits, or act by the sum on two. So the types of unitaries that appear are all just sort of supported on one or two channels and implement one of these three.
And they can't mix in any way.
I'm not sure what you mean by mix, but...
Like that the sum acts on two, and then you also act with Fourier and R on the same channels afterwards.
Oh, yes, yeah, certainly you can. Yeah, on the same channels after. It's just that any given step in my circuit, I'm acting by one of these operations.
Well, then
if your steps are parallelizable, can you compress the circuit?
I don't want to. So I explicitly won't parallelize. So each UI is exactly one of this on the ith channel, this on the ith channel, or this in the ith jth channel, I and jth channel, say, or qubit. So we don't parallelize. Even though it actually wouldn't be a big problem. It doesn't, because the tensor product of balanced operations is balanced, and parallelizing is just taking the tensor product. But at least for this, I won't parallelize. Any other questions? Cool. So yeah, my modulus is just the number of Fourier gates that appear. The functional is the following thing. So we see that there's only two places that phase factors come in at all, right? It's in the Fourier gate or the phase gate. Yeah. So this thing will be, well, the first is that from the way I wrote it over here, I wrote e to the I of s something. So to get these to line up, I need to divide by 2 pi over d, because I was using this root of d over here. So there's a 2 pi over d in the front, and this is actually relevant. So I sum over all f gates. I'm wondering why I have a minus sign. Let's see if it makes sense. So on every f gate, I look at, I'm supposed to have a phase which is related to the value that's incoming to that particular gate and the value that's outgoing, right? because this is sort of the incoming one, the outgoing one. So, and the function is, I look at the path gamma, I look at the value it has at the input of f, and I multiply that with the value it has on the output of f. And then I add up all the argates. I suspect this minus sign is a mistake, given what I've written already. Well, it's this same phase factor, but it only depends on the input value, we'll say, which is the same as the output, but it's this following function. Let's do this. N minus 1, following thing. Okay. The idea over here, the value, my functional S of gamma, was the sum of all of the phases that appear in the circuit. And this is just another way of writing this. Right? I have a phase for every in gate, or for every F gate, and one for every R gate that appears. And there's no phase contribution from the sum gate because there's no phases. And the final piece is the paths of non-zero amplitude. I'm not going to expressly tell you what those are, but rather say that you can parametrize them by essentially adding a variable for every Fourier gate. So it's going to be some subset of a number of auxiliary variables defined by the number of phase gates, or number of Fourier gates, with the idea that the R and sum gate acts deterministically. So once I know the input, I know the output. So that sort of constrains what my non-zero paths can be. Because if I try to, you know, any path where it's not the case that every R and sum gate, the values are described according to the non-zero matrix elements here, it'll be zero. So I only need to have sort of variables to parameterize my paths for Fourier gates. So this describes those variables. But I will say that you have equality exactly when each qdit, the final operation on it, is a Fourier gate. So each, we'll say, qdit terminates with a Fourier gate. In general, this will be an intersection of affine hyperplanes inside here. Because you essentially, for every gate which doesn't end in a Fourier, you get a linear equation that has to be satisfied between these variables. CY isn't hugely important, but you can at least parametrize these things. So that's what I wanted to say about the sort of setup. What I wanted to talk about now is what's sort of one implication of having this sort of formula for the matrix elements in a Clifford circuit. But before I move on, does anyone have any comments or questions? If not, I'll plunge ahead. All right. Oh, yes?
I didn't really understand the last.
The last thing, sure. So why don't I draw a small example? You might see what I mean. I'm doing this without notes, so if I make a mistake, don't hold it against me too much. So if I look at a simple example that say is on say two qdits. So I have some sort of preparations here. I don't know. My first guy, my second one. Right? So this is my initial state. I should write that so it's legible. And I'll do some operations. For example, maybe I'll do a Fourier gate here. And then, I don't know, maybe a phase gate here. And then I'll add the two results together. So this is how I draw my sum operation. And then I'll post select on, or wonder about computing the amplitude here. So this is, I've already broken my own rule about saying I won't parallelize my own drawing. Here we go. And now I have 1, 2, 3, Q1, Q2, Q4. So I want to compute the, I have this given circuit, and I want to know what's the amplitude going from particular values of Q0 to Q4. So let's describe how I might parametrize what my non-zero paths are, right? So I know that the only way for me to have a non-zero amplitude, let me, I'll draw time steps, this might help. So first of all, what's my overall configuration space here, right? So for every time space, or my space of paths, right? So for every time step here, can people see these colors? Yeah, OK. Sort of each time I apply a circuit, I have another copy of my configuration space maybe coming in, right? So this might be sort of Q1, Q2, Q3. So what possible assignments of actual values to Q1, Q2, Q3 would give me non-zero amplitudes, right? Well, the first thing is, I mean, this component, I've done nothing to this channel, so this one has to be the same, right? The value of whatever path that's on this channel has to be the same as it was here, right? It also has to be the same here. Right? Because the R gate is diagonal. Right? Whereas here, after I've applied the Fourier, every possible assignment has a non-zero value. Right? Every possible position or path in my circuit has a non-zero value because this matrix has no zero matrix elements. So let me just stick in a new parameter there to indicate the fact that I don't know what the value of this should be. Let's call it x1. Right? The fact that I can't determine just from the matrix elements when this will have a non-zero path, right? But every other point after this is completely determined, right? Because this is a deterministic operation if you want. It only has non-zero matrix elements on the diagonal things. Same thing sort of here, right? So we see that the only place where I had any sort of freedom in how I prescribe a path with non-zero amplitude was here. So I had to add, if you want, an auxiliary variable to parametrize that choice. Right? But not every possible assignment of this value is compatible with my fixed values here and my fixed values here. Why? Because, well, what happened to it after it came through here? Right? So it had to be the same value here and the same value here. And this value has to agree with this. So there's a constraint on this assignment, which is that x1 actually had to be the same as whatever my post-selected final position was. Otherwise, I'll have zero amplitude. Okay? And there's a second equation, which actually says that x1 plus q02, coming from the sum gate, right, had to be equal to this one. So in fact, this is empty, unless these values line up particularly well. For a lot of things, there will just be an empty sum, and so you'll have zero transition amplitude. So this is sort of demonstrative, maybe, because I assigned a parameter for every Fourier gate that appeared. And I get a set of constraints that say sort of these values that I track through have to agree with the final points. And these are always linear. So it's going to be some intersection of the solutions to some linear equations. But, and this is going to be relevant in a second, you can always pad a Clifford circuit, because the Fourier gate has order 4. Right? So if you apply 4 Fourier gates in a row, you get the identity. So you can always change your circuit without changing the unitary so that every gate ends in a Fourier gate. But yeah, shall we look at the next part? How can we see a variant of the Gottesman-Mill theorem? So schematically, to evaluate, if you give me a Clifford circuit to evaluate the transition amplitudes, what I need to work out is a certain type of sum, right? I mean, it's no effort to work out the constant here, right? The thing you need to work out is this certain exponential, the sum over exponentials. It's the part that actually requires some work to do. So schematically, what sort of sum am I trying to evaluate here? Well, the first thing is that this is completely determined by a polynomial, right? I mean, there's this 2 over d, but this is a polynomial, right? So this thing is a polynomial with coefficients in z mod d. And how many variables is it in? Well, I could parameterize my paths by the number of Fourier gates. So in NF variables. What degree is this polynomial? Well, it turns out it's always at degree at most 2. Right? Because these are all quadratic in the input and output values. And yeah, that's why it's degree 2. And the fact that all of these sort of equations that come up are linear, so I can't get higher order things from it. So schematically, the type of thing you're trying to evaluate is a sum where you're summing over some values in some number of copies of Z mod D of this following type of expression. Right? This is what you're trying to evaluate. An expression of the following form, where P is such a polynomial over Z mod D it's at most degree 2. So these are known as quadratic Bay sums. And it turns out you can very explicitly evaluate these without actually summing everything up. I mean, there's an exponentially many terms here. If you just plugged it into a machine and it's like, OK, I just want to add up all these values, then when you have exponentially, it will grow exponentially in the number of Fourier gates if you just sum them all up. So naively, you might expect that it's very difficult to evaluate them. But it turns out number theorists are good with these types of things. And you can compute it. And the way you do it is you use the following two things. The first is that sort of the case when alpha is equal to 1 is a little bit of work, but you can evaluate them. So if you have a polynomial of the following form, so you have some fixed lambda and some fixed mu, both in Z mod D, and you want to evaluate this sum. This is sort of analogous to evaluating a Gaussian integral, right? Except it's the sort of finite field version of that. And you can evaluate it. It's quite explicit. So if the easy case is if lambda and mu are both 0, right? We should all be able to do that one. It's just D. It's the number of elements, right? Each of these is 0. The other easy case is if lambda is 0, but mu is non-zero, in which case this is 0. It follows from the fact that, you know, if mu is non-zero and this is 0, you just have a term like this. And this is that formula for d roots of unity, right? You can factor w to the d minus 1, which you know is equal to 0, is the same as, you know, w minus 1 times w d minus 1 plus 1, right? How you can factor those. And the final case, which is the one that actually requires work, is when they're both non-zero. Or well, at least lambda is non-zero. Then you get something like the square root of d. You take your dth root of unity and you raise it to this expression, mu squared over 4 lambda. And then you have a factor which depends on a and lambda, which is either 0, I, or minus I. And it depends on, for example, whether p is congruent to 1 or 3 mod 4, and the Legendre symbol of a and lambda. So it's some number theoretic thing, which the details of which aren't important, but it's explicitly evaluatable. And this, given a and lambda, is easy to compute in a sort of computational sense. So for in one variable, you can have an explicit formula. So if you combine together this fact, which with the fact that you can diagonalize quadratic forms over FP efficiently, or you can diagonalize degree 2 polynomials, say, polynomials efficiently. By which I mean, people can still see over here. Yeah. By which I mean you can take something of this form and find a change of variables and do a change of variables so that this becomes a product over things of the form that I just wrote. It's essentially, if you look at the purely quadratic part, you diagonalize that. That's sort of the work. And that can be done efficiently. So if you put these things two things together, it implies that you can evaluate quadratic Weil sums in polynomial time and sort of all the different variables. So you can efficiently evaluate these Weil sums. And so the upshot of this is that because of the sort of form of the polynomials that you get for Clifford circuits, you can efficiently evaluate the transition amplitudes, which says you can, well, that's what you can do. It's a sort of, the Gaussmann-Nil theorem is slightly stronger. It's about a sort of stronger form of simulation of the results, but you can still compute the elements efficiently, essentially by diagonalizing these polynomials and plugging in this formula. But it does give a very different sort of perspective. I mean, the sort of traditional proofs of the Gaussmann-Nil theorem involve the stabilizer formalism, wherein this is sort of more of a number theoretic result. It tells you something about the types of number theory problems you have to do to compute the transition amplitudes are simple to do. This is, for example, I don't think it's even true for cubic ones. For a general degree 3 polynomial, I don't know if there exists in a sort of an efficient algorithm for determining it. In this case, it's barely an algorithm. It's like Gauss 100 years or 200 years ago or so computed this, and now we can do it. But it does give a different perspective on sort of the efficient simulatability of these things. Relates it to a very different type of problem. Are there any questions? So now I can talk a little bit about, so maybe one thing you might not be satisfied with is that in the Feynman path integral, the action isn't just some arbitrary polynomial built out of some variables or something, right? It's distinctly related to the classical system that you use to get the quantum system, right? It's the action functional. This is a very familiar and maybe comforting item to have when you're doing quantum mechanics, the fact that you just have the action function appearing there and playing such a central role. Whereas here, this was a polynomial that I built by basically just looking at the matrix elements of my unitaries that build the circuit. So is there any sense in which you can understand this polynomial that appears for Clifford circuits as an action? So that's what I'm going to talk about now. So the first question is there isn't even any sort of natural sense in which you'd have something like an action functional for discrete systems. I mean, it's not the type of thing you open up Arnold's book on classical mechanics and be like, oh, by the way, this is what you mean by actions for discrete systems. So I need to tell you what a candidate for the action is to do this. So let's take a second to look at how the action sort of appears in a way which doesn't explicitly make use of any of the sort of things we don't have in this discrete setting. So if I start with a Lagrangian, so where does the action come from? So if I start with a Lagrangian L, then from this, I can build the following thing, which I'll call S classical. It'll depend on two position variables, which should be thought of as the initial and final position. And it's defined to be the integral. I also have some time here, which I'm suppressing in my definition, of the value of my Lagrangian and its derivatives. Sorry, at the position, hold on. The usual expression, but evaluated on a particular path. So it's not on an arbitrary path. It's on the path where this q classical satisfies that at time 0, it's my little q. At time t, it's my big Q, and it's the solution to the Euler-Lagrange equations. I mean, it's the actual classical trajectory followed solution. So this is a function which only depends on the endpoints, assuming I have a unique solution to the Euler-Lagrange equation. And it's a function of the two endpoints, and it just evaluates the total action of the classical trajectory. So this should be thought of not as an action functional, but the total action. I don't know if that actually needs scare quotes. It is what it is. So obviously, a definition about integrating over a Lagrangian is not a helpful thing if I don't have a Lagrangian. I mean, maybe I could get away with summing, but there's no obvious Lagrangian here. But this function of two variables satisfies some interesting equations, which is the first thing is that my initial momentum is the same thing as the derivative of this thing with respect to the initial position minus it. This is a fun exercise you can find in Arnold. Similarly, the final momentum is also the derivative with respect to the final position. So what this actually tells you is that if I take the exterior derivative, or I think of this as a one form, then this is the following thing. Right? So P, if I look at the difference between the one form, which is my final momentum, times my initial position, minus the initial momentum times d of the initial position, this is what finds, or sorry, I should have my little classical here.
So the idea is it's a one form on like the product of configuration space with itself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is a one form on m squared, or my configuration space squared. And this is an equation satisfied by, it's essentially saying that, I mean, this is known as the tautological one form on m, right? In fact, no. It's better to say this is on, yeah, we'll say m squared. I mean, this is sort of measuring the, I mean, if you take the exterior derivative of this, it's the symplectic form, right? So this is sort of saying, well, I know that my flow preserves the symplectic form, but if I only look at this level, it has to be up to a closed thing. But either way, this expression is one that you have access to for any symplectic morphism. So any transformation QQ, which is symplectic. So initially, the notion of a total action for a trajectory was related to ones coming from Lagrangian dynamics, right? But through this, if you give me any symplectic transformation, phi, symplectic, this expression defines a notion of the total action of phi. Where phi could be any symplectic map which isn't necessarily coming from flowing along a Lagrangian, but it does have an associated notion of the total action for that transformation, essentially by defining S through this equation. I look at the difference in these two values for the final momentum and the initial momentum, final position, initial position.
Can you just explain here? So
yeah.
You take the exterior derivative of that, and then you get something like the symplectic form of the of phase base squared.
Yeah, so.
And you are saying vectomorphisms is still on phase base squared somehow.
Yeah, so I'm being a little flippant about my ability to rewrite things. So the most careful definition is I'm working on the cotangent bundle of my configuration space, right?
Sure.
And on the cotangent bundle, the one form, so if I'm on any, this is true for any m, right? If I'm on the cotangent bundle, the one form is always of the form, say, d theta, where theta, so this is the symplectic form. You can always write it as the exterior derivative of some one form, and this is often called the canonical or tautological one form.
Yeah.
Right? So if I have a symplectic map from the phase space to itself, right? Then it being symplectic says that if I pull back this, it's the same as this. Right? That's the definition of a symplectic map. I pull back the symplectic form, it's symplectic. This turns into a different expression for theta. This implies that the pullback of theta minus theta, so the difference between preserving theta, has to be a closed one form. Yeah. Right? But if you assume that all closed forms are exact, then this has to be the same as d of some function. And it's that function. So it's the thing which measures the failure of the symplectomorphism to preserve the canonical one form. It's maybe a slight diversion, but sort of geometrically, that's what's going on. Yeah.
So this is now just for fixed phase space.
Indeed.
This structure,
yeah.
You just say our configuration space is M squared, and I just take the phase space of that.
No, I'm also abusing the fact that, I mean, if the cotangent bundle of M is trivial, this is the same as M times M. So over here, I'm basically abusing the fact that I can rewrite the momentum as a function of just Q and Q. So I'm implicitly abusing a few things, but this is fine if M is like the real numbers or something. Right? But yeah, essentially it's, and really this should be a function of, say, Q and P, right? But I'm abusing the fact that will be true in all the cases that I use that I can rewrite P here as a function of these two variables. Essentially that, yeah, it's some sort of statement about the invertibility of some Jacobian or something. But yeah. But at least in all the cases, you can always just rewrite it in terms of these two. So the takeaway message should be that there is a way to define the notion of at least the total action of any symplectic map. That comes from the fact that the total action of the flow along the Lagrangian does satisfy a sort of inherently geometric definition, which doesn't explicitly refer to integrating the Lagrangian or anything. It's just defined in terms of the underlying geometry of the total symplectic transformation. Why is that relevant? Well, for Clifford circuits in odd prime dimensions, you can represent every one of the elementary gates in terms of a certain symplectic transformation. This is the Wigner representation. So let's have a look at that. And I have to be somewhat quick here. So this is due to, I should take another step first. So how would you go from having the total action for a symplectomorphism to defining something like an action functional for some sort of discrete time dynamics? So what do I mean by that? Action functional. So let's say I have a sequence, I'll call phi, of symplectic maps. Each phi is a symplectic map from my phase space to itself, right? Well, I can define this function. Well, to each phi I can associate the total action. So I can associate this function, say, S of the whole thing, which we'll take as input, say, n plus 1 positions, which should be thought of as the value on a given path through n steps in my configuration space. Sorry, an n step path through my configuration space. And I'll simply define it by the types of expressions you've already seen, where it's the action on each of the time steps. So if you think of an integral, right? How do you, the action functional just says it takes a path and it evaluates, it integrates over the value of the Lagrangian along that path. So that's sort of like summing over the total action in each infinitesimal time step. It's sort of what an integral is. It's maybe a little sketchy. So when you're in a discrete time thing, well, you don't need to worry about a sketchy analogy. You can just say, in each time step, I have a total action associated with this particular transformation. I can sum over all of them. So this is the, if you want, the action functional for phi, this particular dynamics, which is a sort of a discrete set of dynamics that's just given by saying I apply this sequence of transformations to my phase space. So if I have a Clifford circuit, then I claim I can associate such a sequence. So this is called the Wigner representation, or the Wigner transformation. Due to at least in this version, due to David Gross, which says the following. To each one of the elementary gate sets I wrote down before, these elementary gates, I can associate a symplectic map from either z mod d squared to z mod d squared for the f and r gates, so sort of one dimensional or one qubit phase space, or from z mod d to the 4 for the sum gate. And here's what they are. If I have the f gate, I associate the symplectic transformation, which takes q and p to minus p and q. The r gate goes to, and these expressions might not mean too much, but I thought I'd have them there for concreteness. I don't change anything to the position, and I do this funny transformation on the momentum. And finally, the sum gate does the following. It acts on 2, and it sends it to, well, it does nothing here. It adds these two together, which is what you'd expect. It has a sort of back reaction, if you want, on the momenta and fixes the second momenta. Make sure I wrote that correctly. I didn't even write up my notes, so we'll hope it's right. So essentially, I associate the following symplectic transformations. To each one of these, I can associate a total action to this transformation. And so from a circuit, I can build an action functional. So the total actions look like, well, let's do a calculation. If I look at the Fourier gate, right, I want to look at the difference between the final momentum, d of the final position, minus this. So let's write this down. So it looks like minus p, so the final momentum is my initial position, right? So if I write p dq minus little p d little q, what is this? So big P is little q, big Q is minus little p, minus p dq. And what happens here? This is the same as minus, oh yeah. There should have been a minus sign here, I guess. And that's where this one came from. Good. Well, I say that. I might have just made a mistake again. This is the same as the exterior derivative of minus pq. This is the Leibniz rule, right? Oh, that should also look like a q. But I can, in this case, I want it to depend on big Q and little q. But I know that minus p is the same as my final q. So this is d of q, q. So this is an example where I can write my final momentum as an invertible function of my initial things. And you might notice, coincidentally, that this is the same thing that appeared in my face. Here? And this continues. The total actions of each of these gates is exactly the thing which appears in the phase here. So similarly, so that says that the total action for my transformation f as a function of big Q and little q is just the product. So my minus sign up here was wrong again. Not sure why this is there. Actually, I think that's in the published version we had, so oops. No one tell. Yeah. So similarly, for the R gate, the total action looks like exactly what's written there. I should, of course, say that these actions are only defined up to an additive, to a constant. So I'm just choosing the constant. And similarly, for the sum gate, it's the zero function. So what we find is that the action functional that I would define here agrees with the polynomials that appear here. So the sort of phase factors, so essentially the sort of summary here is if I have a Clifford circuit, I can associate to this a sequence of symplectic transformations. And from this, I build a a functional, S of phi. But I also built one directly from the circuit that we had before, and these are the same. So the upshot is that the sort of the phase factors that appear in the sort of just the path sum formulation of Clifford circuits actually has an interpretation in terms of an action. But in the process, you have to sort of say what you mean by an action for discrete things, but it is sort of naturally connected to the geometry for discrete dynamical systems in the same way that the phase factor that appears in the Feynman path integral is related to the geometry of the dynamical system. I think I'm out of time, so I'll stop there. Thanks. Yeah?
You might have said this, but like, given that you have associated an action to your system, can you externalize that action and get
that's kind of a very good question. Yeah. So the first thing is that this action I wrote here, actually, I should maybe have been more careful with notation. This particular thing here, you noticed, is not a real valued function, right? I mean, this takes a little q and q lie in z mod d. So this is a z mod d valued thing. So I should have actually, to make this proper, I should have put a 2 pi over d here, right? To make that equation actually hold. So essentially, the polynomial which is up here is the one which is the sort of action for this discrete system. And you have to get a 2 pi over d. So the first thing is extremizing in the sense of finding the smallest value doesn't really make sense. Z mod d isn't ordered. So then you might ask, well, what other notions of extremizing are there? And none of the sort of natural candidates seem to give anything that looks like reasonable. So I don't have a good answer for, and it's the type of thing we've actually thought about quite a bit, because it'd be a very nice sort of confirmation that this is the right notion of the action. But there's no sort of obvious stationary or least action principle for these discrete systems. It's not hard to formulate things like Hamiltonian mechanics. That's easy enough to do in this discrete setting. But directly defining something like Lagrangian setup seems a lot harder. So even finding like the Euler-Lagrange equations is quite odd. Like, there doesn't seem to be a good formulation out there. But it is a very good question, one which has sort of bothered us for a little while. And I really should have said this at the beginning. I've said us a few times. This is all joint work with Dax Coe and Rob Speckens. So us refers to them, yeah.
Oh, great.
We can go, yeah.
Could you speak more about the qubit case now that you have defined the Wigner?
Yeah. So there's a few things which are and aren't problematic. So the first thing is, in the qubit case, I already mentioned this, but so when you have d being an odd prime, all of the matrix elements here are either 0 or dth roots of unity, right, for a fixed d. They're all just powers of this thing. For qubits, you don't have this because of the phase gate. Right? The phase gate is I and minus I, and they're fourth roots of unity. So sort of in the background here, I've been abusing the fact that I can, not abusing, but I can think just in terms of polynomials over z mod d for the actions. Whereas now, you'd need something where you sort of have polynomials over z mod 4, but when you do the path sum, you're not actually, your configuration space isn't z mod 4, right? It's based in terms of z mod 2. So you have this funny thing where you're like summing over only part of the values in your z mod 4 configuration spaces. You could still sort of write it. The bigger problem is that the proof here explicitly uses the fact you're not in characteristic 2. Very important. Because you need to divide by 2. It's a common problem. Like, you can't complete the square for z mod 2, right? If you have if you just have an arbitrary, you know, how do you write this as something of the form, you know, x minus c squared plus d, right? You complete the square to do that, you divide by 2. You can't do that in characteristic 2. So it's actually not true that you can efficiently evaluate degree 2 polynomials over any field or ring of characteristic 2. So this is maybe a completely different way of getting at the same sort of fact that stabilizer, qubit stabilizer things is not, admits things like proofs of non-contextuality and so on. So it obviously doesn't imply that, but it says the same sort of argument about how, oh, actually computing the transition amplitudes is an easy number theory problem isn't true anymore. So it's at least a sort of connected thing. I think you had a question, yeah?
Yeah, I was just wondering if there's other circuit families that you can classically efficiently simulate now.
Yeah.
Not just Clifford.
The sort of statement is, you can, if you have any balanced circuit, right, where you need to start sort of enumerating the things I used, right? I got that the action, the polynomials that appear here were degree 2 over a finite field of odd characteristic, right? And also, though I didn't mention this here, that I could sort of easily enumerate the paths I had to sum over. Because if I didn't have this trick, which I mentioned, implicitly in saying I evaluate a sum of this form, I've padded my circuit with Fourier gates at the end. Because otherwise it had to determine what subspace I'm summing over here. And then you get into the problem of like, can I efficiently, in this case, before padding, it's some intersection of affine hyperplanes. Can I efficiently compute what intersection that is? Maybe, maybe not. If it's more complicated, you could imagine that maybe I don't get linear equations, but maybe I get some arbitrary, strange, high degree ones. Then maybe here. So you need sort of a combination of statements, which is it's a degree 2 polynomial. You can efficiently determine the space of paths, and then you can do it. There is a class of circuits where the same argument works, and it's in fact one where we got this idea from. It's in this unpublished paper from, I don't remember all the authors, but the lead author was a guy named Bacon, who's a computer scientist, I think, where they have what they call linear algebraic circuits. So it's a setup where you have the Fourier gate and basically two other phase-changing gates, which are sort of a 2-qubit and a 3, or like a 2 and 3-channel phase-changing gate, if I remember correctly. Okay. And in the same situation there, you get something which only has degree 2 polynomials. In that case, since they're all phase gates, the space of paths is, there's no equations that you have to cut out, so it's very easy to determine. So the same sort of argument applies there. But those are the only two classes I know of off the top of my head.
So you can efficiently classically simulate these linear algebraic gates?
Yeah.
I see. And that's complementary to the Clifford circuit?
Like, yeah, they're different. Yeah, they definitely don't. I don't think they can, I think the linear algebraic ones can't implement the phase gate. They can implement the sum, but not the phase. So it is strictly different.
Cool.
In the continuous case, you can use some of the paths to sort of for any situation, whereas in a discrete case you're restricted to certain types of circuit.
Yeah.
Why are those two cases so different?
Yeah, that's also a thing we've thought about. So it's good. So it seems to be. It's a short answer to this. So one thing is that already in the path integral, like the usual Feynman story, you do often implicitly restrict your space of paths. For example, if you're doing the double slit setup, or just not even as complicated, but you're talking about passing through if you have a barrier, right? Maybe I don't need to draw a picture, I can do the interpretive dance version. If you are talking about, say, what, when you're doing the double slit experiment, you have a wall, you implicitly don't consider paths that go through the wall, right? Because they will have zero amplitude, right? That's not something that you typically actively think about in the formalism, but you do, in some sense, restrict to paths with non-zero amplitude. But the fact that that seems to be not a common issue does, yeah. I mean, it is true that you can write down an expression that mimics Feynman's story for any sort of circuit. I had it on the board earlier. It's just your amplitude will have sort of the thing you assign to each path won't have constant modulus. So you could more generally have a formulation where rather than having that you're only sort of integrating over phases and you have a fixed modulus, you could have one where the weight of every path is has both an amplitude, varies amplitude and varies phase. But that's not the type of thing that's sort of typically considered in path integrals. It doesn't come up very often. I know examples are in things like if you have decoherence and you try to do sort of formalism for path integrals where you have an open quantum system in decoherence, they'll have setups where you have an, some damping effect from a changing amplitude. But yeah, it's I don't have a clear answer. But
can I add something to that answer?
Absolutely.
It seems to me that already when we talk about the dynamics of a continuous variable system, we are restricting the natures of the unitaries we're going to consider. So, you know, for example, I can define an arbitrary unitary on just two positions. Like if we forget, like, you know, Q and Q prime. So now I think of that as a qubit lying inside, like, infinite dimensional hyperspace. Of course, I can define a unitary that is not balanced on that qubit. It takes me from, you know, 1, 0 to 3/4, 1/4 weights. And so that would be a, like a non-balanced unitary for continuous variable system. But it's not the kind of thing that arises from a natural Hamiltonian, and so it's not the kind of thing that we ever had to worry about. So in some sense, it might be just that the class of things that arise from natural Hamiltonians are the analogs of the circuits that arise from balanced gate sets. And the stuff that don't arise from balanced gate sets are like these anomalous cases in the continuous variable, which don't describe real dynamics.
So those anomalous cases can't be treated in the path integral approach easily?
Unless you move to these situations where it's not just a sum of phases, but you have a non-trivial variation of the...
then do you have an action then? Is that the...
Well, that's where it's kind of... there's this whole field called influence functionals, and there is a connection with action, but it's not as clean.
This is one. This is more of a general comment, but one thing that you start to realize fairly quickly when you try to sort of think, it, you know, push path integral formalisms into places where they're less common, is the fact that it turns out every time that people write down a path integral, it's an ad hoc procedure about how to define it in this particular context. So, you know, there probably are places where people talk about how you would evaluate a path integral which has varying amplitude. But it's probably very contextually specific and uses sort of, you know, usually approximation techniques which are like specific to a particular problem. So it becomes hard to sort of answer general questions because sort of every setting has its own way of dealing with the sort of problems that come up.
So writing down an action is sort of the first step in many branches of mm-hmm. physics, so the sort of mm-hmm. something that undermines that would be interesting. So sort of, it's a first step.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some more general class of interest in physics, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Did you mean to say action or Lagrangian?
I meant the action. I mean, it could be Lagrangian, I suppose, instead.
So, but I don't see how we challenge that insofar as we also have a kind of an action functional.
Okay. Okay. Then maybe I misunderstood.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they probably do write down the Lagrangian first, right? They write down, you know, the Lagrangian density and define the action from
right.
that. So usually specifying, you know, what are the fields of interest? How do they interact? Like, what's the Lagrangian density is what they do, and then the sort of action, well, not this one, the functional, is the thing they use. I feel like that, this is going to get opinionated, but the sort of emphasis that they place on how sort of defining of the theory the Lagrangian is, I find is a little suspect because that does define the sort of classical aspect of the theory, but the quantization procedure is also a thing you have to put in by hand. It's not as if there's a well-defined notion of path integral quantization. You like to pretend there is, but there isn't. Every different one they write down has a different approach, which involves very different mathematics and different concepts every single time. So I feel like a lot of people will talk about the path integral, like the specifying the Lagrangian as if it's the be all and end all, but there's also sort of a separate quantization story that's different in every case, which goes into these sort of ways like, okay, how do you actually evaluate it? What does that mean?
Can you give any thoughts to a case of non-unitary evolution? Yeah,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you mean something more general, like completely positive maps, or?
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know, the analog in quantum theory would be like Euclidean path integrals, for example.
Oh, OK. I definitely haven't. The Euclidean story is, yeah, I don't have much to say about it, but the somehow at least the nature of the type, you know, here, so people often like the Euclidean formulation in usual path integrals because it isn't oscillatory, right? It's exponentially decaying. It's good for computing things like bound states, whatever. Here, I don't know if you have the same sort of the same sort of interests. Like, I don't know if we care that much about computing ground states. It's not really the same sort of problem. And the other thing is, what type of sums would you get? So rather than getting oscillatory sums, you'd get some sort of exponentially damped finite sums. I'm not sure what. Yeah. I don't know what to say about it. But I mean, one thing is there's no obvious Wick rotation. Is one thing. How do I go if my, you know, the usual formal thing of sending t to it doesn't have an obvious meaning because, like, I don't usually that, usually the way it changes the action is you have things like time derivatives or explicit functional dependence on time. I don't have discrete end derivatives. I'm not sure how that would work. And there's also usually no explicit dependence on the number of time steps except in terms of the number of variables. So I wouldn't even sort of naively know how to write something like a Wick rotation, just even on a formal level, but also not sure what would motivate doing it. But.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's work again.